Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking about hidden gems you'll want to check out on your science-themed vacation this summer. Stuff like geological wonders, strange museums, atomic-era oddities. So give us a call with your recommendations. I know you've been to lots of places for a geeky road trip. Give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Or tweet us at SciFry. We'll get to that a little bit later. But first, another story about a mysterious and intriguing place. Archaeologists excavating an Aztec temple site in what is now Mexico City have uncovered a tower filled with hundreds of human skulls. This terrifying tower was described in the journals of invading Spanish soldiers in the early 16th century. Joining me now to talk about the find and other selected short subjects in science is Annalee Newitz, tech culture editor at Ars Technica. She is at KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tower of Skulls sounds like a horror movie or a ride in Disney World or something like that.
This is one of those great examples of actual archaeology proving that something that sounded like the crazy ravings of Spanish invaders was actually true. So, as you were saying, we have written accounts from Spanish soldiers who were coming into the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, and they're with Cortez's invading forces, and they record seeing a tower made from skulls, and they're just terrified by it. And for hundreds of years, since this tower and of course all of Tenochtitlan were basically buried under Mexico City, we haven't known for sure if this was just a wild exaggeration. But this ongoing excavation in the heart of Mexico City has revealed that there was indeed not just a tower of skulls, but some other structures that were covered in skulls too. And the tower would have been about 6 meters in diameter. It's round. And it wasn't full of skulls. It was sort of decorated with skulls. Skulls were sort of sunk into the structure of the tower.
And there are people of men, women, children, everybody? No one more than the other?
That's what it seems like. And that's one of the exciting things about this excavation is that now scientists have gotten enough skulls out that they can start analyzing, you know, a little bit about who these people were that wound up with their heads in a tower. And this is one thing that the Spanish got wrong, because these were soldiers coming in and they saw this tower and they expected that it was to frighten them away,
right,
and that it was probably the skulls of dead soldiers and that would make them men. But instead, it's actually from a cross-section of the population. It's women, children, men. And what this tower was it was part of a temple to a god who is associated with human sacrifice. And so instead of it being intended to frighten away soldiers, it was really to provoke awe in the citizens of the city and to be a kind of spiritual reminder, because human sacrifice in the Aztec religion was part of the cycle of life. You couldn't really live as a civilization without sacrificing. And so this was a spiritual place. It was not, it wasn't like a Game of Thrones thing where we put the head on a spike. It was really a religious kind of icon. And so the Spanish kind of got it right, and they kind of got it wrong.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We'll have to follow that story. Let's move on to a new topic. There's an old stereotype that attributes cognitive lapses or memory problems and other mental effects to women's menstrual cycles. And now there's this new study that looks at that.
This is, in fact, one of the only studies out there that actually takes a cultural myth, like the idea that women are kind of out of their minds during their periods and takes it seriously scientifically. And there have been a few other studies that have tried to tackle this, but none in a terribly scientific manner. And so what these researchers did is they took a group of 68 women in Switzerland and Germany, and they created an experiment that had reproducibility built into it, which is a basic tenet of science. So they looked at these women during two of their menstrual cycles, which for some crazy reason, no one had ever thought to do. They'd only looked at women during one menstrual cycle. So, of course, they could never know for sure if what they were seeing had anything to do with that, had with the menstrual cycle, because they weren't able to repeat it. So they took women through these two cycles, and they did a variety of cognitive tests on the women during their two menstrual cycles. And they tested ability to have working memory, visual memory, concentrate on two or more things at once, so basically multitasking. And they also measured cognitive bias, which just looks at whether prejudices kind of overwhelm your ability to make a rational judgment. And what they found was that when they took into account both measurements, during both menstrual cycles, there was absolutely no relationship between cognitive performance and where you were in a menstrual cycle. So some women did not seem to perform quite up to typical cognitive levels during their first menstrual cycle, but during the second one, they did. So that clearly shows that it wasn't related to the menstrual cycle. It was something else, because when they tried to reproduce the experiment, it didn't have the same cognitive deficits didn't come up. So the researchers really want to continue in this area with this research. They really feel like there needs to be more work done on women who have, you know, hormone deficiencies and other problems. So these were all women who had typical hormone levels. So just women who have average types of menstrual cycles. So feel free to go memorize philosophy while you're having your period. It's all good. You're going to be just as up for it as you would be normally.
I'll keep that in mind.
You and your friends can keep that in mind.
That's right. You have a story about the emergence of frog diversity. This is very interesting. Give us the background on that.
So people who are fans of dinosaurs may know that about 66 million years ago, a giant rock smashed into the planet and kind of wiped out most of the dinosaurs. But what that rock also did during the subsequent mass extinction was kind of pave the way for a lot of other life forms to really take off. So one of those life forms was, of course, a little furry shrew known as a mammal. That's our ancestor. We were all descended from this little shrew. And this other group that really benefited from the mass extinction was frogs. And it turns out that three lineages of frogs wound up being the ancestors of 88% of frogs alive today. So those three lineages that made it through the giant rock hitting the planet have basically blossomed into this huge number of frogs all across the planet.
I guess this was kind of surprising, kind of interesting. Wow. All those frogs coming from those few frogs.
Exactly. And it's fun to think about what made them good survivors, because we don't think about frogs as being particularly robust. But they actually managed to find a new ecosystem niche, because flowering trees became incredibly common after this mass extinction. Before that, it was mostly pine trees, conifers. Right. And frogs love flowering trees. They love those big flat leaves that fall on the forest floor. They can hide in them. They can lay eggs in them. And it became basically, Earth became the perfect frog environment. So the dinosaurs, you know, not so great for them, except for the ones that evolved into birds. But frogs were just loving it.
Tweet perfect Earth environment for you on that one. Thank you, Annalie.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Annalie Newitz, a tech culture editor for Ars Technica in San Francisco. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now, how do you know if something weighs a kilogram? If you're the average person, you get out your scale. But that scale had to be calibrated, and the calibration requires a standard. And that standard is a 100-year-old hunk of metal locked away in a vault in Paris. But that could soon change. An international effort is underway to replace that chunk of metal with a more mathematical solution. And one team just announced a new precision measurement of Planck's constant that could help pave the way. Sounds complicated? Well, here to explain why this is good news and the potentially massive complications is John Pratt, Chief of Quantum Measurement Division of the Physical Measurement Lab at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yay. Hi, Ira. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you. Let's start with the benefits, the good news. What's good about ditching that metal cylinder?
So I think the first thing to ask is what makes a good standard? And the idea is that a standard should be universally accessible, and it should be a fixed quantity. It should always be the same. And one of the things you just described, the hunk of metal over in Paris, well, at first glance, it's pretty obvious that the existing standard sort of fails that universal accessibility test. It's only available in Paris. I have to get on a plane and take hunks of metal over there to compare to it. So that's a problem. And increasingly, because of the precision with which we're able to compare hunks of metal, it's gotten to be an issue of whether I'm picking up mass while I go to the bathroom, while I'm sitting on the plane and I leave my mass unattended. Anyway, the other problem is that we know from recent experience that the mass itself, the IPK, sort of fails the second test about always being the same quantity. We know this because we pulled out the IPK as part of this business of trying to measure the Planck constant, and in the process we discovered that the existing mass scale based on the IPK appears to have shifted by 35 parts per billion. And we can't say whether it was the IPK or whether it's the masses that we're hauling around, but that's a problem with these types of artifact systems.
All right, let's talk about the solution and what is being proposed.
Okay, so our new approach tries to solve this problem by basing everything on things we think of as constant in the universe, things like atoms and more specifically atomic frequencies, the speed of light, and where we get to Planck constant is this issue of the idea that energy is quantized, and so we have a quantum of energy that's scaled by the Planck constant. So we have a couple of ways in which we can do experiments that link mass to the Planck constant.
Uh-huh, and that's not going to change anytime soon. You know, is anybody going to notice the difference? Why should we care about this?
Why should you care about this? Well, one of the games we play in the standards world is to make sure that nobody has to care. So the care we take in trying to make this transition from a standard that's based on the hunk of metal to a standard that's based on this sort of abstract idea about the quantization of energy in the universe, is that we want both approaches to agree with each other. And we want to be able to do that at the level of precision that's being done at the moment. And that's what's presented a real challenge with coming up with an alternative strategy, is that we can really do a great job of comparing hunks of metal to each other.
I got to go. John Pratt of the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We're going to take a break when we come back. Your science road trip. Stay with us.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you visit Rome, and I hope you do, if you haven't been there already, one of the things that stands out is the number of ancient structures that you can still see today. And it's not just massive slabs of rock. Over 2,000 years ago, the ancient Romans built piers and breakwaters and other structures out of concrete. And some of those structures are still standing. What did they know about concrete that we don't? Because we see concrete crumbling on our roads today. Writing this week in the journal American Mineralogist, researchers unearthed the geology and chemistry secrets of that ancient concrete and how the interactions of seawater with volcanic ash actually make the Roman concrete stronger as it ages. Joining me now is one of the authors of that report. Marie D. Jackson is a geology and geophysics research professor at the University of Utah and an expert on Roman concrete. Welcome to the program, Dr. Jackson.
Hello.
You know, listeners to this show know that concrete is one of my favorite topics. I don't know why, but I'm fascinated by it. So I am delighted to speak with a fellow concrete geek like yourself.
It's pretty interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff. Okay, so what's the secret? Well, what did the Romans know about making their concrete that we don't do?
Well, Romans had a very different framework for making the cementing fabric of their concrete. The first step was to mix volcanic ash with lime, that is calcium oxide calcined from limestone, and water. And in the architectural monuments, they used fresh water. And in the marine concretes, they used seawater. This produced a very potent reaction called a pozzolanic reaction that created a really robust framework of coherence in the concrete. That was the first step.
Yeah.
And Vitruvius in De Architectura described these materials and processes, in fact, in a lot of detail. We described that in a 2013 American Mineralogist paper, and now we've discovered that the mineral cements that form over time come from the corrosion of the volcanic ash that's left in the concrete as seawater percolates slowly through these very massive structures.
And so what happens? The concrete changes into the minerals change?
Yes, it does. And in fact, Romans expected it to change, and they created a material that thrives on this kind of change, that's very different from the way we make concrete today.
Well, could we take what they've done and put it in our concrete?
Many people are working on that now. And in particular, they're looking for materials to mix with conventional cement-based concretes that can reduce the amount of cement used in the concrete. This will reduce CO2 emissions and add to the durability of the concrete. And those are indeed called pozzolanic processes. There's another step beyond that, and that's what the Romans recognized, is those materials can perhaps react over time to create ongoing mineral cements that reinforce the cementitious fabric over time in a kind of self-healing process.
Now, I know that I called you a concrete expert and a geek, like, I'm just a geek, not the expert, but how did you figure this out? I'm curious about it.
Well, I'm really sort of fascinated by both the architectural concretes in Rome and the harbor concretes. This is in large part due to a drilling program, the Romacons drilling program, that drilled harbor concretes through the Mediterranean, 11 different harbors. And all of those concretes have the same fabric. Romans shipped this special volcanic ash from the Gulf of Naples all over the Mediterranean. And in the relict particles of lime grows a very unusual mineral called aluminous tobermorite. We described that in great detail in 2013. And now we found that tobermorite grows through the fabric of the concrete. This is a platy mineral that has some very important industrial processes, industrial applications, but we have a great deal of difficulty making this mineral. It's the Romans who were the masters of making this very unusual mineral.
How do you think they stumbled on this? And, was it by accident?
They actually wrote about it. Both Pliny the Elder and Seneca write about the volcanic ash deposits of the Gulf of Naples and how these deposits grow mineral cements. So they were actually using a geologic framework to develop specific properties in their concretes. They were very intelligent people. And so what we are actually recognizing is a rock-like process that grows these zeolite and tobermorite cements. In fact, volcanic deposits in seawater, certain ones of them do grow these cements as well.
Wow. Is it? Let's compare our concrete today and the Roman concrete. If we were to build a modern road using their concrete, would it last longer?
Well, you've actually brought up a very important point. The way Romans constructed and the way we construct is very different. So the objective, I don't think, is to build Roman structures in the modern cement infrastructure, cement and concrete infrastructure, but rather to take the principles of the Romans and apply them to improving our concretes and finding other innovative applications for the kind of mineral growth that they developed.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't have to put reinforcement in their concrete like we do rebar and things like that.
They did reinforce their concrete.
They did.
In fact, those very large structures never have been tipped over on the seafloor, even during enormous storm surges. What they did is they made a conglomeratic fabric, that's what a geologist would call it, of large chunks of rock, either volcanic rock or carbonate rock, and this forms an internal framework in the structure through which they packed this very sophisticated mortar.
Wow, so they did, they were great engineers. Great engineers.
Yes, they were.
Well, this is quite fascinating. So are you going to continue? You're looking at the application of this to nuclear waste storage, are you?
Well, that's one direction it can go. It can go in many directions. Aluminous tobermorite is a layered mineral that can capture large cations in its inner layer spacing. And part of what we did in this new study is look at the bonding environments of aluminum and silicon in these crystals. And they do indeed have the kind of structures that material scientists have determined are important for that kind of cation exchange. Aluminous tobermorite is a candidate for cesium and strontium cation exchange, and it's been considered for cementitious barriers around waste encapsulations, but nobody knows how to make aluminous tobermorite bearing concretes. Uh-huh. At least they haven't until now.
Something to look into. Fascinating, Dr. Jackson. You know, you give me any excuse to talk about concrete and not to confuse it with cement. Like people do.
Well, the Romans never used cement.
There you go. Well, they weren't from Portland. Thank you, Dr. Jackson, for taking time to be with us today.
It was a pleasure.
Marie,
thank you.
You're welcome. Marie Jackson, research professor in geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. Next up, it's summertime. And that means it's time to hit the open road. And being a bunch of geeks here at SciFry, we wanted to take a science-themed road trip. Like, how about visiting the Nazca Lines of the North in the California desert? Or how about a mystery that long perplexed hydrologists? A really cool thing, a disappearing waterfall in Minnesota called the Devil's Kettle. Whoa, I want to go see that. And if it's too hot to go outside, you can geek some peace of mind at a museum full of preserved brains. Well, we'll show you how to get there. These are just a few of the obscure gems recommended by my next guests in their book, Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the Hidden Wonders of the World. Ella Morton is the co-author and senior editor at Atlas Obscura. And Dylan Thuris is her co-author. He's also co-founder and creative director of Atlas Obscura, and they're here with us in our SciFry studios. Welcome.
Hi there.
Thanks for having us.
And we have a map. You want to do the road tour? We've got the map for you, our destinations on our website, sciencefriday.com/roadtrip, sciencefriday.com/roadtrip. Ellie, let's start off with you. Give me some of your top picks. And because we want to ask our listeners also at 844-724-8255 to phone in things they visited. What What's some of your top picks?
Well, one of my favorites is the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, which is this museum full of jars of strange and wonderful things. You've got a skeleton that looks as though it's melting. You have this collection of skulls that each one has the manner of death listed, and it's some very sort of evocative things like killed in a battle with Austrian sharpshooters. There's also a papier-mâché model of a giant distended colon, which is a particular highlight. I'm really into that one. Yep. And there's also a lithopedion, which is a stone child. And that's when a fetus starts to grow outside the uterus and calcifies. And the particular specimen that is at the Mutter Museum was in this woman for 24 years without her noticing. So you can go and see that little stone child at this museum, which is just absolutely fascinating.
You know, I'm looking at our Twitter and our calls in, and that was, many people have suggested going. It's in Philadelphia, right?
Yes, it's a particular favorite. And it's funny, you sort of think of these things as obscure, but when we were on our book tour, we found that people of like mind regarded this place as a highlight.
It certainly is. Okay, Dylan, what's on your top pick there?
I have a place that most people don't have any idea exists called the Mississippi River Basin Model down in Jackson, Mississippi. And so this was perhaps the greatest scale model ever built. In the 1940s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers needed to model hydrology. Basically, they were having a terrible problem with floods. Floods had destroyed huge parts of the country. And so in the age before computer modeling, when they said sort of let's model this problem, it meant building a gigantic model. So over a couple hundred acres, they built a 1-to-100 model of the entire Mississippi River Basin. It's about 8 miles of tiny little streams, and it's a perfect accurate model of about a third of the U.S. It started in World War II using prisoners of war as the engineers, actually, and the labor. And it took about 26 years to finally complete.
And where do we see it?
It is now basically abandoned. It
is being, that right?
That's right. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers left in the 90s, and the town of Jackson, Mississippi hasn't really had the funds to keep it up. So it's in a park called Buddy Butts Park in Jackson, Mississippi, and you can go out there, and people use it to drive RC cars on. A lot of people, I think, go there and have no idea what they're seeing, but what they're seeing is the remnants of truly the greatest scale model ever constructed.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with the editors of the Atlas Obscura about the road trips you can take. Let's go to, see if I got a quick phone call in before the break here. Let's go to Nathan in Chicago. Hi, Nathan.
Hello, how are you doing?
Hey there, go ahead.
I got a chance a couple years ago to go to Austin, Texas, and on their big kind of hip street, East 6th Street, they have a spot called the Museum of the Weird, which is kind of fun. Not that expensive either. I believe it was like $12. And it's if you're interested in like cryptology or like they had the Minnesota Iceman, they had a couple of the weird displays on like the old Bat Boys, like the things you would see in the tabloids that you wouldn't necessarily believe in.
All right.
And at the end, they had one of the tour guides do a little bit of a display where they kind of showed the old tricks where they would take a long nail, witness a person take a long nail, put it in their nostril, and just casually take out a hammer and just hammer that little buddy straight into their nostril towards the very end of the museum. So that was it's a very interesting spot to check out, not that expensive.
Yeah, don't eat before you go there. It's like the Mutter Museum. You don't want to have something.
Yeah.
I think LA, you'd probably like a place like that.
Absolutely. And this is a sort of genre that we have a lot of places of in the book, is this sort of small museum. We have quite a few involving cryptids, actually. There's a skunk ape research headquarters in Florida, for example. And the sort of one-person museum is something that we see a lot of. There's a museum run by one woman that is dedicated to Victorian hair art. Stuff like that we just adore, because it's clear that the person running it just has this great abiding passion for the subject in question.
Yeah, these little, like the giant ball of yarn, that sort of thing, and are there those small museums?
Absolutely.
I think we especially, like the example that the caller brought up is sort of this classic dime store museum or these, you know, sort of pseudo-scientific places. I think we find them interesting because, well, the science is deeply wrong. The kind of folklore and stories that arise around this stuff is still interesting. It's a deep sort of part of Americana.
Well, that's sort of the theme of the atlas is places you wouldn't be thinking of or find. And how do you collect some? Do people send stuff in, or are you just out on a road trip someplace?
So people send stuff in. That's the whole way it works. Is basically people send dozens of things in every day, and it's incredible that after doing this for, you know, 5+ years. Surprising stuff comes in every single day.
Now, we're going to get back to some more surprising stuff and also stuff that our listeners would tell us about. Maybe something you can put in the Atlas next edition. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, talking with Ella Morton and Dylan Thuris, the co-editors, co-authors of the Atlas Obscura. And we're talking about where should you go visit this summer and take a road trip to see obscure things. It's from the Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the world's hidden wonders. You can also go to our website. You want to get on the road, sciencefriday.com/roadtrip. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're taking your geeky road trip recommendations with my guests Dylan Thuris and Ella Morton, co-authors of the book Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the hidden wonders of the world. And one that's mentioned in your book, one of the places I discovered by accident years ago, I was doing a story on the Big Bang, and I went to New Jersey, and I went to Holmdel, and where, you know, they were talking about, I was outside looking at this giant horn there, we were talking about the Big Bang, and sure enough, it was the background radiation was discovered by accident in that spot.
One of the great stories of accidental discovery. I mean, they spent, the scientists working there spent so long trying everything they could think of to get rid of this static that they was interfering with the research they were trying to do. They thought it was pigeon poop, right. You know, and then it just so happened that another team put out this paper saying, you know, there should be actually this kind of background noise that we would hear. And suddenly it was this aha moment. They were never going to get rid of that sound because that was the sound of the Big Bang.
It led to the Nobel Prize in physics. So antennas and radio telescopes and things are interesting places to visit. And you go visit them, right?
There's a ton all over the country. You could do a tour of just those and have a really good time.
Ella, where would you go next? Well, give me another recommendation.
Oh, well, this is a slightly different genre, but we're big fans of bioluminescence at Atlas Obscura. And one example is the synchronized fireflies in the Great Smoky Mountains in Tennessee.
Stop there. Synchronized?
Yes, they flash at the same time for mating purposes. We've just missed the season this year because it tends to occur over about 2 weeks at the end of May, beginning of June. But you can go there. There's even a shuttle in this section of the Great Smokies in Tennessee, and you can just watch the fireflies glow at each other in a synchronized way. It's a sort of visual orchestra. It's all together. And there are a few examples of this, like, around the world. It also happens in Malaysia, where they flash at the same time. But we're big fans of the combination of entomology and glowing.
Right. let's glowingly go to the phones. Let's go to Baltimore. Brandy, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Well, last year, my husband and I were in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we discovered the Museum of Atomic Energy, which tells a whole story of the discovery of the development and use of atomic energy. I'm not the geek in the family. My husband is. So I especially like the section that takes you to a secret place, Los Alamos, during World War II, and it enables you to see how the scientists and their families lived there when no one was supposed to know that they were there. You can also see a replica of Fat Man and Little Boy and go inside a fallout shelter.
Wow. Wow. I still have plans in my drawer about how to build one. It's good for people who are not sciencey geeks and they can understand it a little, is what you're saying.
Give a shot.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that suggestion. Ella, Dylan?
Atomic tourism is a whole thing.
It's a world.
Is
that right?
I was just thinking about, there's a gravestone just outside Chicago in the Red Gate Woods, and it says on it, caution, do not dig. And what's buried beneath it are the remains of the world's first artificial nuclear reactor, which was built at the University of Chicago during the Manhattan Project. And so you just walk past this tombstone in a park where this incredible thing happened that went on to change the world. There's also the Trinity site where the bomb was first detonated, and where Trinitite, the
Trinitanium, I think.
That substance was created.
Yeah, the sand, basically, when the atomic bomb, when the weapon went off, the sand was turned into a kind of glass, and right. It can only be found in this site.
Let's go to New York, right here. Tyson, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about House on the Rock in Wisconsin. It's an hour west of Madison, and basically it's a gigantic collection of oddities, and it has basically airplane hangars full of collections, including a 200-foot-long sperm whale being attacked by a giant squid, and hundreds of automatic music machines that are just like the size of entire rooms. And no one really knows about it, but it's just incredible.
Well, the folks in this room, bro, were throwing up their hands in joy. Ella, what do you know about this one?
This, I'm going to turn over to Dylan, because Dylan is from Minnesota, and it involves a childhood road trip.
This might actually be like my conversion to weirdness moment. I went to the House on the Rock on a road trip with my parents when I was 12 years old. And the thing that's hard to explain to people about this place is it genuinely takes 6 hours to walk through. It is gigantic. And it's this weird sort of liminal place where the real and the unreal come together. That giant sculpture of the squid fighting the whale, the size of a Statue of Liberty, anatomically very strange. It's a lot of it was made by local artists. There's almost nothing like it in the country. It's got to be one of like our greatest national treasures.
All right, it's a great recommendation. We have some tweets coming in. Tucker notes that at San Francisco Bay, there's a model of the bay in Sausalito, California.
Yes, that's another one of the big hydrological models. Yeah. It's a little smaller scale than the Mississippi River Basin, but another just incredible example of, I believe the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made that one as well.
Let's go to Brandon in West Lafayette, Indiana. Hi, Brandon.
Hey,
go ahead.
Hi, this is Brandon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a scuba diver, and I travel around the country trying to find weird places to dive. And I've dove in two different missile silos. There's one outside of Abilene, Texas. That was an Atlas missile silo complex. And then there's a huge Titan missile silo complex in Royal City, Washington, that you can go, and they're flooded. They're about 120 feet of water, and you can scuba dive in them right now.
Is there stuff growing in them?
No, it's just the crystal clear water. And the Washington one still has all the metal cages and the elevators and a lot of the electronics inside it. The one in Texas is pretty much just a concrete tube, but 5 stories underground. You have to go through the blast doors to dive, and it's just a pretty cool experience.
Wow, well, you have to bring your own lighting with you, I imagine.
Yes. The one in Texas is set up with lights, but the one in Washington State, you have to bring all your own lights. You have to crawl. You have to walk through tunnels where the water is about chest deep until you get to the silo, and then descend. And yeah, you have to have every light, everything you need, because there's nothing down there.
Yeah, this is not for the amateur. You got to know what you're doing.
Actually, yeah, I mean, they're fairly safe dives. There's still air above you. You're not completely underwater. Yeah. Most normal divers can do it, and you can even tour some of these without being a diver.
Well, that's a great suggestion. Thanks, Brandon, and happy diving. You know about this? Have you heard about this?
I have not. There's a Titan Missile Museum in Arizona, but it's certainly not underwater.
Yeah, the specific overlap of dive spots and atomic tourism is like, that's a level deep.
That's our sweet spot.
Yeah, that's right, totally.
Let's go back to the neighborhood, to Tulsa and Laurel in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, go ahead.
I was calling to recommend the Museum of Osteology in Oklahoma City. They have over 300 animal skeletons, including a whale and a giraffe. It's really cool.
You know about that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's the home of Skulls Unlimited.
Skulls.
the best place to get your skulls, whatever you need.
Yes, it's a skull cleaning business. And it's combined with the Museum of Osteology. So you can send them, well, you can send them your carcass of an animal and they will clean it and provide you with a mounted skeleton.
Do they use those beetles?
Yes, exactly. And it's fascinating to watch these flesh-eating beetles that will eat their demested?
Dermested beetles.
Beetles. They will eat it down to its bones. It's fascinating.
Wow. Wow. There's so many things to do. Let me go back to the phones. Let's go to David in Post Mills, Vermont. David, welcome to Science Friday.
Post Mills. I'd like to recommend something in Paris, France. There's a series of brass monuments set into the ground and concrete sidewalks and things. And even in the courtyard of the Louvre, it's a monument to an original meridian line. There was a meridian line in Paris before Greenwich was established as the standard. And there are probably 30 or 40 of these medallions set in the ground. And they're just there to walk by and see. And it's just a nice piece of history.
Dylan?
Yeah, those are totally amazing. And all the kind of that period of establishing all of the standards, the moment when like no one was sure where the meridian line was going to be, the U.S. kind of wanted it, like Jefferson was pushing for that. But Paris had a ton of this. I know they also, they had, you know, the meter reference when they decided to go to that system, they created a little marble thing so people could go and say, oh, this is the exact length of a meter. It's actually a little off. So they had to, when they made metal rods later, and Paris is still home to the only reference for standards, which is the kilogram. Everything else has gone to a physics, you know, it's some fraction of a cesium atom for the second, but the kilogram is still a hunk of metal. And there's the main one, the international kilogram prototype is in Paris, and there's others all over the world, and every once in a while they all come together and they weigh them all, and they make sure that they still weigh the same, which they kind of don't, which is a problem.
We just did a story. I heard a story about them trying to do away with that standard because
everyone, I've talked to the guys at NIST, the National Institutes for Standards and Technology, and it drives them out of their mind that there's still like a chunk of metal that is how we measure this.
Yeah, there are a lot of markers everywhere. You know, you look down on the ground and wherever you go, and sometimes there's a geological survey marker that says this is exactly where you've been.
Yeah, you know? Always read the plaque.
How about close to us in Canada? Any places in Canada you might suggest that we go visit?
Sure, I have one that I'm really dying to get to, which is a very peculiar type of telescope. It's a Mercury telescope. So this was something that was theorized by Isaac Newton, that you could, when you spin a liquid, it forms a little parabola, and you know, with something shiny like Mercury, you could use it to make a huge lens. But it took a really long time for the technology to sort of catch up with the idea. So this particular one, which is the largest in the world, was only made in 2003. And, you know, provides a really clear, beautiful picture of the stars. There are some downsides. One, it's a giant dish of mercury, which is fairly toxic. And two, it can't be tilted. So it only points straight up into the sky. But NASA still has plans to maybe try and build one of these on the moon.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. We're talking about where to take a road trip. You still have the whole summer ahead of you. You want to drive around, see some geeky, science-y things with Dylan Thuris and Ella Morton, co-authors of the book Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the Hidden Wonders of the World. And let's talk about an event that's coming up that we're all hoping to see in our own way, and that's the solar eclipse on August 21st. And we've actually teamed up with you folks at Atlas Obscura for an event in Oregon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that weekend, the weekend of the 19th, leading up to the morning of the 21st, about 11 o'clock, we're doing a huge celebration of the eclipse. So in the Snake River Valley in eastern Oregon, We are getting scientists and musicians and artists. National Parks at Night, which shows you how to take photographs of the night sky, will be there. We're doing a science of brewing thing there. And
that'll bring people in.
You guys will be there as well. Science Friday will be there alongside all these incredible scientists and musical acts. And it's going to be just a huge celebration of this.
Yeah, and I guess
celestial event.
And while people are on the road to that event, they could stop in at these other places.
That's right. It is the perfect opportunity.
That's a wonderful idea.
For the great summer road trip.
The great summer road trip. And I'll just repeat that we have that great summer road trip. The destinations are on our map at sciencefriday.com/roadtrip. It's sort of a Google map up there. You can see all these sites up there. Speaking of Oregon, I think I have another call. I have just time for another call from Mike in New York. Hi, welcome.
Hi, yes, I have some Oregon ideas for you guys. Not long ago, I did as I always do in the summertime. I spent some time at a fire lookout tower out west, and this happened to be in Oregon. And I stumbled across two sort of plant-related sites that might interest you. Maybe you might want to go there during your eclipse of adventure. One is the humongous fungus, which is purported to be the largest living organism. Not much to see, frankly, except the devastation that the plant does to trees, because it's underground, it's an underground organism. And then something a little bit more visible, about maybe 150 miles away, is a colony of cobra lilies, which is an example of a carnivorous plant, and they're found only in Northern California and Southern Oregon. And so you can actually hit both of these sites within a day road trip.
Wow, thank you, Mike. That's great suggestions. I saw Ella jumping up and down at the humongous fungus.
Yes, well, I have a bone to pick with the humongous funguses or fungi because they stole the crown for the largest organism from Pando, the trembling giant, this clonal colony of quaking aspens in Utah, which is beautiful, but it's been suffering from blight and drought, and so I think these fungus mats in Oregon have stolen its crown. But Pando shall rise again. I just want you to know. I have belief that it will rise again.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming by. And this is a great book, The Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the Hidden Wonders of the World. It's huge. It's a great coffee table book, but you want to look through it because it's got all kinds of great stuff in it. And we're reminding everybody about our event in Oregon on the 21st of August up there. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Dylan Thuris and Ella Morton, co-authors of the book, Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the Hidden Wonders of the World. Thank you all on the phones for those great suggestions. One last thing before we go. For all you geeks out there, did you know you can celebrate Science Friday every day of the week? We just launched a Science Friday store. You can get all kinds of sci-fi bling out of there. Sweatshirts, beaker mugs, periodic table clocks. I have one of these in my office. It's really cool to look at. Get your geek on at sciencefriday.com/store. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer, Christopher Ntaliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You can send us emails, scifry@sciencefriday.com. And it's all, every day is Science Friday now because we're tweeting and on our Facebook page. You know how to find us. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.